Howdy, you're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the You and My Discography podcast, a show where a You and My fan and a You and My super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waits, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia. I'm the You and My fan in the equation. My co-host and You and My super fan is Sydney sider Jono Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast and general man about town. Jono, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Tom. How are you? I realized I never really ask you. You always ask me and I just go on about how I'm doing and I never really ask you back. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm marginally worse than when you asked me how I am before we started recording about 2 minutes before in that we're recording as the Socceroos are playing France in the opener, and when we we're about to start recording. It was 1-1, and I've got a sneaky Google live tracker of the game open, and we're now 2-1 down. So I'm if I had to put a number on it, I'm 2% less good than when you asked me 2 minutes ago. But apart from that, kicking goals, taking names, doing all right.
Beautiful, mate. Yeah, good week for me, to be fair. I saw Tim and the Twin Set play a gig in my hood earlier in the week, and I also discovered during the week that Liquid Lunch, Tim's radio show, has returned with new episodes for the first time in months and months and months. So overall, a good week as a Timmy / You Are My fan, and happy to be here and pretty bloody excited to talk Convicts.
Indeed. So today in episode 7, we're talking Convicts from 2006. Before we get stuck into the record, a quick disclaimer. Myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to UMI. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with the group known as UMI. But if not, give their records a go. Go to the show. Send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Jono, you seem like a man who spends hours reading ASIC's literature on mutual funds to figure out the best way to invest your winnings after you win $2 on a scratchy. How do you think this disclaimer holds up from a legal perspective?
Look, that describes me pretty accurately, but like a certain record, there's so much more to me. But yes, I think we're good.
All right, great. Just to take a step back for a second, you mentioned you saw Tim and the Twin Set. So, well, I've always been intrigued with his the Temperance Union and the Twin Set. Like, what constitutes a Twin Set show? Is it like consistency in the other band members, or is it the format of the band? Like, talk of can you give me some elaborate on the configuration of the side bands, because it's something I've always wondered about.
So the Twin Set was the band that Tim did his debut record with, so What Rhymes with Cars and Girls. So they did one record together, and then from there I think Tim formed the Temperance Union, so played with a few other players, and I think Shane O'Mara was the main feature as guitarist there. I think Ian Kitney maybe, and Stuart Speed as well. In the Twin Set, you've got the main feature there is Davey Lane on guitar and Jen Anderson on the violin or strings and things like that. So they reformed. I think they played an anniversary show, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, and played the album right through. But they've played the 20th anniversary, I think, show. I'm not sure why they brought this band back together, but there's a new album coming up basically in 2023 where Tim is basically writing sequels to each of the songs on What Rhymes with Cars and Girls. And he's brought this band back together with Jen and Davey. And yeah, it sounds like a great concept. The songs sounded good too. Unfortunately, Tim had a throat infection, so he was struggling with the voice. But in a way, it was quite sweet. The crowd really got behind him, and it was a nice vibe in the room. And he was in pretty good spirits considering. And it was nice to see how Davey kind of steps up, and he really stepped up on the backing vocals, and the way he kind of looked at Tim with concern but brotherly love at the same time. It was a kind of a sweet night, even though it was a bit unfortunate about Tim's voice, but it was a kind of heartwarming feeling, I guess.
Nice. Well, you've cleared that up for me. And speaking of Davey backing vocals. This is an album full of them. And so I guess just if you're a first-time listener, we've gone through all the other records, so go back into our catalog if you want to get up to speed. But the format for the show will be as follows. To kick things off, we'll talk about what led up to the recording of Convicts. Then we'll go through the record track by track. And finally, we'll talk about what happened after the album dropped. Give our gold, silver, bronze medals for our respective three fave tunes on the record. So, Jono, Convicts, which comes 4 years after Deliverance. Can you give me a little window into what happened in those 4 years between Deliverance?
Yeah, I can indeed. Firstly, though, I think a bit of housekeeping before we get straight into Convicts, if I may. Now, I want to take you all the way back to our first episode, Sound As Ever. Now, last week we were delving a little further into the naming of the album Deliverance. It meant something a little more than just a cool sounding title, et cetera, et cetera. And I was listening to Liquid Lunch and Tim was telling some story and mentioned how Sound As Ever got its name. So I never knew this, but Sound As Ever was apparently how Graham Parsons used to sign off his letters, and that's why they named it Sound As Ever, is a bit of homage to that. So that's pretty cool. And so now we know where Sound As Ever came from. Ali Daly, number four, are pretty self-explanatory. And we discussed Dress Me Slowly and Deliverance last week. So the only gap now is Hi-Fi Away, which, you know, is the name of a B-side from those sessions. It sounds cool. Maybe that's just it. But I reckon we can find out somehow if we put our minds together. Dear Lord. So the title Convicts, though, is pretty straightforward one. I don't even know if we have to explain it, but Brits often use the term as a pejorative for Australians. And you and I copped it from time to time back in the day. There's a line from Tim's song, High Weather Support Band, from What Rhymes With Cars And Girls, where he goes, the local PA guy's a dipshit, keeps calling us all convicts. There's an example. So there's some housekeeping about titles that we've been discussing the last couple of episodes. But on to Convicts, the record now. So, yeah, as you say, when we're thinking about Convicts, more than most other records, I think we do have to consider what came before. So we spoke during the last couple of eps about the perhaps chastening and maybe confronting experience for the band through the Dress Me Slowly and Deliverance years. You know, Dress Me Slowly, a tough recording experience, and Deliverance, I guess, kind of low-key in a way, and maybe confirming that the band wasn't any longer in the top echelon of popularity and that was okay. And then following Deliverance's release in 2002, Tim released two solo records with the Temperance Union, Spit Polish in 2004, brilliant, and the epic Ghost Songs Dirty Ron double album from 2005. And I guess we should also mention, because I do think it is relevant, that around those years, Tim's relationship had gone south, and there was also those incidents that we kind of discussed with Holden and Missy. So a lot going on in those years. And so when news came of the release of Convicts in 2006, near on 4 years after Deliverance, I remember emotions that I would describe as a mix of the following: excitement, arousal, and relief. Because, and this might be a topic for discussion, I don't think the band ever broke up, but the band has been a bit inconsistent about that. But there was no guarantee, in my mind at least, that they'd make another album together. And because of all that, because of that mishmash of stuff, Convicts did have the feel of a comeback. Some people took it as a comeback of a band who'd broken up, not me. Some people took it as a comeback of a band who returned to form after a bit of a dip, not me. But to me, it does feel like a band re-energized, of a band that's bursting with a renewed purpose. And really, it only takes a couple of seconds after pressing play to realize that. So to put it simply, if I could, Convicts hits you hard, it hits you often, and it hits you fast. There's definitely an intensity and a desperation on Convicts that's probably the leading perception of the record, but there's much more to it. So I reckon we can get digging, because it's a ripper.
Yeah, well, this was kind of, as I've just mentioned on prior albums, kind of the record that really got me and mainly due to some experiences with seeing the band live after this album came out. But I recall reading about, this was kind of like a reset of the band or something after, those years in the wilderness. And what I find funny is that when that happens with a band of some notoriety where they've been, they've been together for a while, they've had some side projects, and then they kind of get back together and it's kind of positioned as a rebirth or reconnecting back to the roots. What generally seems to eventuate is an album which purports to be rock and roll stripped back, but it's produced by Mark Ronson and has a strong pop funk feel to it. And you're like, oh, damn it. I was swindled by the fucking music journos once again. But
yeah,
I feel like this album is the sound of men in their 30s or early 40s back in the garage and actually cranking out tunes like they would have 15 or 20 years prior, except they have years of experience playing together as a band, a rekindled enthusiasm and kind of love for the game and each other. And I think just the way this album is recorded is immaculate and amazing. I have just one quote from Rogers, which I found on Wiki. Tim Rogers later said of the album, "It hadn't been a great couple of years, and it's even worse when I look back at it now. I had no confidence at all, so I wanted the guitars too loud and everything aggressive and loose." So I think this is kind of a perfect indication when life gives you lemons, sometimes you just got to get the band back together and fucking crank out an amazing rock and roll album. So that was my kind of like memory of the anticipation of the release of Convicts. So let's jump in. Let's go to track one. Thank God I've Hit the Bottom. Jono, take us away.
Yeah, so from the time I started following UMI in 98, I obviously read everything that I could about them, interviews, reviews, street press, mags, newspapers, all that sort of stuff. And I remember seeing Tim reference a few times his yearning to make a really direct record. And in my unformed musical mind, I was like, I wonder what that means. You know, what does it mean? More anthems? Are we heading to the stadiums here? But then I heard Thank God I Hit the Bottom, and I was like, that's what he meant, you know, direct, in your face. You're left in no doubt as to the state of mind here. And this is probably a good time to note that one thing you notice about each new You're My album is that there's always a distinction compared to the previous album. I'm not sure how conscious that decision is, but it's often stamped on the first song. You know, Junk from Number 4 follows Allie Daly. Ain't Gone and Open follows Coprolalia. And immediately with Thank God I've Hit the Bottom, there's an enormous contrast to Words for Sadness from Deliverance. And you know straight away that this is a totally different ballgame. This will be about, unfiltered emotions and thoughts, and it will be intense. So, a song that is really like no other in the whole UMI canon, and it's pretty bracing way to start the record.
Yeah, well, I remember being surprised when I first heard this, and I think it took like one or two listens, but then it kind of clicked, and because I've never been really a punk guy, I've always liked punk when it's been paired with something, kind of like punk and hard rock, or like I guess a little bit of pop punk here or there perhaps. But when I first heard this, I was like, wow, this is straight up punk. But upon further inquiry, I think it's the encapsulation of their kind of like power pop sensibilities, which was evidenced like from the beginning on Sound As Ever, and I guess songs like Berlin Chair and things like that. But then, as you said, stripped back and no pretense, no bullshit, just aggressive, trash your hotel room directness and kind of aggression. And I don't want to make this about me, but just very quickly, I've written a book, and I start the book with a bang, not quite an artful bang as this or clever in any way, shape or form. It's quite a literal bang, but I have to say, this song kind of inspired me to begin the book in the way that I did, because the way I see it is that if you start with such a punch like this, anyone who's left, they're up for anything. They're like the people. Everyone at the pub says, yeah, let's go back to mine for afters. Let's do it. And everyone's gung-ho and like, yeah, it sounds good. But then you either have to navigate or walk in the cold or get an Uber. And then, but the benefit of if you actually get back to the afters and so you know the other people there who are cracking open tins at 4 a.m., you know they're up for anything. And you know they're going to stick around to the bitter end. So that's what I think is the genius of kind of starting in this way, is that you weed out the weed from the chaff. Is that the expression, the farmer? You really – it's kind of like an amazing way to launch into this record. That's kind of my general thoughts. Just quickly – a couple of one thing I noticed that I didn't really put together, but there's the lyrics. I've been picking fights with graffiti artists. Hey, and I believe that's a real story, which he explains in Detours. If you remember, there's that part where he accosts someone in St. Kilda, throws his spray can down the street. So that was cool.
Then he wakes up the next morning, sprayed across the wall is Tim's a knob or something.
Yeah, totally. And just thinking about how the themes of this album, and it begins with Thank God I've Hit the Bottom, it ends with I'm a Mess. The way I see it, and I'm no expert on kind of any of the 12 step or Alcoholics Anonymous vernacular or kind of literature or how they see the world, but as far as I'm aware, you can either have like a high bottom or a low bottom. And I think that like a big part of it is like how you frame your bottom can inform like your recovery. So the way I see this is like, thank God I've hit the bottom. It's kind of like it takes a positive outlook on hitting the lowest point in your life. And if I had to kind of put that into a metaphor, I'd say like this song is a bouncy ball getting dropped from a skyscraper down onto the street, the hard bitumen of the CBD. And it's one of those big fucking bouncy balls that's not going to disintegrate. Yeah. And so when it hits the ground, it hits with extreme velocity, it pancakes on itself, but then it just has extreme velocity going back up as well. So I think that encapsulates the kind of disarray and the disintegration, but also the kind of euphoric rebirth that can come with hitting your bottom and owning it, if you will. So that's kind of how I see this tune.
Yeah. In some ways, you could say it's UMI's response to Yaz's The Only Way Is Up. The only way is up. You know, it's a similar, similar concept.
Yeah, similar vibe.
A few points to what you said. Firstly, it's a great book. I recommend it thoroughly. Secondly, you don't have to apologize for making this about you. I think I've made the first six and a bit episodes all about me, so it's totally fine. And also, I guess, I can't remember the third bit, but yeah. So, the hotel trashing thing, which, does have that vibe to it. But it should be mentioned that Tim and the band are totally against that.
Disinfecting shit. Keeping it very orderly, leaving tips. Yeah, no, I'm aware of that. But it is fun to even the most courteous, responsible member of society, we have fantasies of things we do.
We have our moments.
Yeah. Yep. So and this would be a great soundtrack to that. But amazing way to start the album. Thank God I've Hit the Bottom transitions into track two. It Ain't Funny How We Don't Talk Anymore. Jono, tell me your thoughts.
Yeah, so we're now seven albums in, and we're starting to see patterns in how UMI approach parts of record making, including sequencing, which is obviously super important for an album. One thing I'm noticing is the approach to the first couple of songs of an album in many ways, and this is probably common, I guess, but they seem to use the first song of the record to set up the record, which, but they really use the first song of the record to set up the second song, which I think they generally think is either the most rockin' or the most emblematic of the record. Now, the opening tunes are brilliant in and of themselves, but I feel like they have an added role to play like a Trojan horse role for the Pretty Boy second tracks. So Coprolalia does some heavy lifting for Berlin Chair, Ain't Gone and Open introduces Rusty to the party for Minor Bird to wow them. Allie Daly sets the scene for Good Morning, obviously, and I could go on. And so in a way you could argue It Ain't Funny plays a similar role to Good Morning from Allie Daly and Who Put the Devil in You from Deliverance, and has a similar relationship to their predecessor songs. It's almost the first song of the album proper. Like the actual first song leaves you feeling a bit disoriented. You know, Where am I? I'm a little flustered. And then speaking about Convicts specifically, the riff of It Ain't Funny, you know, Tim says, let's go. And we're able to find our bearings and we're away. But yeah, I guess it's a song about the damage a bad relationship can do. You know, you're watching me decay, you're patron my decay, I'm the new Pompeii. It's brilliant stuff. And I love the call and response with Davey towards the end of this too, or throughout this. You know, this is Davey's third studio album, and you mentioned this at the top, but probably the first where he really puts his stamp as a vocalist. And, you know, a really good example, his Let's Roll is, for want of a better word, and, you know, I want one, it's rocking.
You know, when you can buy a vowel on certain game shows, you need to buy an adjective to describe.
That's probably, is that the lot of a music journal? Because, like, doing this pod, like, it is hard to find different ways to describe things. And I reckon, like, half the job of a music journal is just penning, you know, flicking through a thesaurus going, what's another word for rocking, or, you know, cool, or, you know, all that sort of stuff.
No, anyway. you we've all got our crutches, mate. You say rocking too much, and my go-to is kind of like, oh yeah, I think I got drunk and stoned to this in 2009. It was really cool, man. I've got a feeling we're that's why that's what I'm leaning on too much. But so but yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that this, it would be a worthy opening track, a good opening track, but the fact that Thank God precedes it adds to it. It's elevates it in a way. And you know, like this is song, you know, a song, I think it was the first single off the album, and I remember me doing my thing I always do, but back in the day in my share house, I used to get drunk and high and watch Rove Live which was short-lived, but kind of, you don't really get that on Australian TV anymore, where I think the ABC try and do a little bit of it, but it was kind of like you'd have some like A-listers, like Will Smith would come on, and then it would just be like the Australian comedians and then like an Australian band. And so it was kind of like a variety show, which is kind of over now. But I remember, I think they played this song live, and they were just kind of very much back in terms of being very well, just a slick delivery and amazing performance. Like the band was kind of flying on.
The only way is up,
little fella. I completely lost my train of thought.
They were firing on all cylinders.
Rove back in the day. And I think that, this song, and also I think Gunslingers is another one where, because I remember this is around the era where like Kings of Leon were getting started in their kind of like early Creedence Clearwater Revival sound. And this is kind of like another instance where you and I have done this multiple times in their career, where there's like another band that's kind of like on an international level and, you know, perhaps the younger, hotter thing. But I feel like Kings of Leon would have killed to have a song like this at the time, and particularly Gunslingers. That's perhaps more of an apt comparison because that's, I guess, more kind of like the similar sound. But yeah, I just think the songwriting's amazing. And as someone who's always liked rock music, but found it annoying when it's gone too far into the pop end, I feel like for me, You and I with their singles, they've always nailed that kind of like knife's edge you got to walk where you don't want to have the hook to sound too pretty. You want it to be rocking enough, and they've done really well on this. And just finally, I'd like to declare a personal Mondegreen. I always thought it was the new Bombay, instead of Mumbai.
Like a colonialism kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that must have been it. I was like, I'm the new Bombay. I was like, I guess there's lots of lyrics on this album you probably shouldn't really overthink too much because it is just garage rock and it's more about how the guitars work with each other and the feeling, not necessarily the takeaway of the lyrics. But I was always like, all right, so I'm the new Bombay. I'm Mumbai. Like, I remember just pondering that and being like, it's too deep for me, Timmy. I'm not going to be able to figure that one out. The new Pompeii makes a lot more sense considering the themes of the song.
Just a quick side note. You mentioned Kings of Leon. I still, decades on now, I still can't quite get my head around the Sex on Fire phenomenon where people would go into stadiums and sing, whoa, this sex is on fire, like without any kind of irony. You know what I mean? It's a weird kind of moment in our history.
Yeah, no, that was pretty bizarre. Like, that was the exact moment I jumped off the Kings of Leon train because I liked the first two albums. Album 3 and 4, I was like, not really sure which direction you're going, but they had enough respect from the first two albums. And then it was the first riff at the beginning. I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm out. And then when the chorus kicked in, I was like, yeah, I'm out. There's a lesson there. That that's probably when they became millionaires, that first chorus. So, they don't care what I think. All right, track 3, Friends Like You.
Yeah. Look, Deliverance is about rediscovering your friends. This tune kind of reminds us that it's not always rosy on the friendship front. Friendships can be problematic too. I love the harmonizing with Davey towards the end here as well. Now our forays into the first 6 You Are My albums, so I haven't had to look up lyrics really, but I did a couple of times for Convicts, and I'm just not sure of the accuracy of some of these interpretations. I don't know how these websites do it. Do they use voice translating software or an algorithm, or whether it's kind of crowdsourced, to be fair, maybe it's just me. But on Friends Like You, at the end of the song, for the harmony that I mentioned, the lyrics websites suggest that Davey and Tim are singing, when you thought she's holding you like she means it. I'm sure it's when good fortune's holding you like she means it. Either works, I guess, but I've listened back a million times once I saw that website, and I still think I'm right. But anyway, Friends Like You, great song. Really keeps the early momentum of this record going. Really rate it.
Yeah, no, cool tune. In that same share house era. I think I thought of myself as kind of like, do you remember Ethan Hawke in Reality Bites? Just kind of like an artist, man, just kind of like, I'm out there doing it. And that's who I kind of like. I was very much like a poor man's, a starving man's version of Ethan Hawke in that movie. And so one of the pretentious things I did is I got A4 bits of paper and I got a stencil, and I would stencil some of my favorite lyrics in the middle of the A4 pieces of paper, and I blue tacked them all around my bedroom. And I was like, I'm going to fill the entire – it was a small room. And I was like, I'm going to fill the entire – walls and the ceiling with just quotes from shit I like. And it would have been very easy to do because I liked a lot of music. I had a lot of lyrics in my mind which were rolling through my head, but I was kind of the epitome of the slacker stoner I was. I didn't get around to it, but I did get like 20 on the wall, and with friends like you, I could throw away my TV was one of them. So that kind of impressed a couple of girls, I believe, that I brought back was like none of the lyrics, but just I was crazy enough to do something like that. I was on the edge. I like the lyrics, the very direct lyric of, because when the going gets tough, she'll kick you in the nuts and watch your Christmas list wither and die.
Yeah.
That's cool. And kind of like last week when you posed the question when we were analyzing the track Deliverance on the record Deliverance, I've got a head full of neon. You put your hand up and said, look, it's been a while since I got involved in any type of illicit substance and I'm out of the game. Give me a clue. Is Head Full of Neon something narcotic related? And I said, I don't believe it is. And we came to the agreement that it was perhaps about city lights and just being overstimulated. On a similar kind of path, at the end of this song, he says, with a French IQ. And I was like, okay, French people, they're known for their kind of culinary delights. They're known for their, romantic ways and eccentric personality traits. IQ, are they considered, like, what is this? Is this kind of like an underhanded jibe? Is he calling someone stupid? Or like, so I Googled it.
Yeah.
And I have to say, similar results, no results with the head full of neon. That there's nothing. But I thought while I was there, and because this is what Google gave me, it did give me the top nation's IQ. So I thought we just kind of deviate slightly from the theme. Why don't you have a guess? Why don't you do a bronze, silver, and gold in terms of what do you think of the top three nations for IQ?
For IQ, I'd say there'd be a Scandinavian nation in there, like Denmark. Maybe like then I'd go to maybe South Korea. And then, yeah, why not a European nation like Germany?
No, you didn't make it to the podium, mate. We got Japan on top with the gold, Taiwan with the silver, and Singapore took home the bronze. So go to Asia.
Canadian sweep. Yeah,
exactly. But anyway, I thought that was a bit of fun and games. Just and kind of in case anyone else was out there wondering, what does he mean by French IQ? Just sounds cool.
Yeah. Interesting, your room as a Ethan Hawke alike when you were a teen. That's kind of similar to how I used to write lyrics on the inside and outside covers of my folders in high school. And I used to kind of like just creep them over into other people's eyesights. So mine wasn't successful, but you did well. Well done.
Thank you. It was well worth my time. Wonder where that stencil is now. Track 4, Nervous Kid. Jono, take us away.
The theme of this song hits me, Tommy. I was a very nervous kid. I was a nervous kid every single day before school. I'd get nervous, not really about anything. I think it was just my nature. Once I was at school, I was generally fine. And I just assumed everyone else felt the same way. But I remember asking a couple of mates years later, I asked them, did you ever get nervous before school? And they just look at me genuinely puzzled. So for this song, while it's specifically about Tim's experiences, it's pretty revelatory for me. And the line, you know, I was eager to learn and prone to sunburn, but essentially just a nervous kid, that kind of hits me and just sums me up, I think. Although I have Mediterranean skin and wasn't really prone to sunburn. But another great outro vocal as well. I think Davey's on board again here. And by the end of this song, I'm just feeling like I've had a two-minute therapy session and that I've worked some stuff out. So I just love it. I love this song.
Yeah, I think it's – I recall listening to the album at the time and loving the fact that – a lot of bands would they'd have the kind of upbeat ones, upbeat tunes for the kind of like track one and two, and then they'd bring it down real early. I like the fact here that like track four still fucking rocking, baby, still going strong. And there was no kind of because I felt, I think you shared a similar sentiment that sometimes comes down too early and you're not ready to come down yet. So I've always liked how this track slots in. I always imagined that if they did the video clip, I could just picture a young Davy Lane being the nervous kid and kind of just filled with rage, but nervous in social situations. And, you know, I think that Tim does the childhood memory song so well. And, you know, what I've kind of realized is that, like, Tim's childhood or tales of childhood or adolescence and awkwardness, anxiety, that's the equivalent of him, of Seinfeld doing the what's the deal with type of joke, where in another comedian, what's the deal with airplane food is hack. But because Jerry's the OG, you're like, I can't wait to hear what the next observation is. Like, yeah, you're into it. And so with Tim, it's like, you know, it's bountiful. I want to go back. I want to hear all the childhood stories. Like, and so for me, this kind of this is just kind of like you can add it to the sub catalog within the catalog of the Timmy childhood. And it's kind of like it references the year that my head broke, Clueless and Free in the ACT. So I guess it kind of spans through to his uni days. Just find a restabout. That's a laborer, right?
Restabout, I thought, was more like a rascally kid or something. That's how
I thought. But I googled it. A roustabout. It says like a laborer or something. Maybe that's a North American thing. But yeah, my impression was that it was kind of like a rat bag. I'm going to commit to being a rat bag, which I thought was the kind of takeaway of it. If you get me out of this one, I'll fucking be who I want to be is how I always interpreted it. I won't be held back by fear.
Yeah, I think – is there like an Elvis movie or song that raps about? But I think – we kind of mentioned it in the past, but no one does childhood memory songs like Tim. Like I know my – I always kind of say that sort of stuff and – I know my musical knowledge is not that wide and broad, but I am sure that no one can get close to Tim when it comes to this kind of songwriting and reaching into the childhood memories and bringing out something that A, is not lame, but B, is revelatory. So I don't know. I guess sometimes I think to myself when I'm thinking about the genius of UMI and Tim that maybe my musical knowledge is just not quite broad enough, and maybe there's other examples of it. But with this particular topic of childhood memory songs, I honestly don't think anyone gets close to him, but I'm happy with people to correct me.
Yeah, and I also just want to mention that it was on the Ali Daily episode where I referenced the fact that if we can't get it together, references the word slut. This song references the word faggot, which is kind of similar to slut in terms of slut shaming. There's nothing wrong with being a slut, blah, blah, blah. Faggot, you can't say that anymore. And it's interesting because it is kind of like a time warp. I think perhaps you and I were like the last generation where that word was thrown around so much. It was usually in a negative context and kind of, to be honest, at least with me, very rarely in relation to anyone's sexuality. It was always kind of thrown at you in terms of like a sense of weakness or something. But I guess it kind of perhaps why you said like no one does childhood songs like Tim and I guess I share the similar sentiment is because it sounds like Australia. There was the dickhead kid on your street riding, you know, who would get in your face and call you a faggot. And,
that's right. Yeah.
And so I think that it's kind of very of a time and place. And it just got me thinking. I was like, oh, yeah, kids these days, like the bad kid now, he's still probably doing horrible things, but he's probably just not using that word. Like it's that's probably like so even the bullies can't even use that word now, which is a good thing. It shouldn't be used. But it definitely I think that when I try and think about what why – even though I wasn't I don't think I had anxiety anywhere near the level that Tim did during his childhood, at least the characters that he creates in his songs, the way he describes it. I think there's something to do with about like similar experiences that you observe, similar language. And
yeah.
All right. Track five, which is kind of another little trip down memory lane, it seems like, is Secrets. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, after a breathless start, you get a bit of space here musically, but Secrets is thematically heavy. So the intensity, I guess, is maintained, but in a different way. I think it's essentially about the deadening effect sexual assault has on a victim, sometimes for a lifetime thereafter. That's my understanding of it. But musically, it slots in nicely. I reckon you kind of referenced it before. I reckon the band would have thought long and hard about where to place this one after the first four songs. But I think it fits in well in track five. Musically, it gives you a bit of a breather after the punch of those first four tunes. But there's still an intensity about it, which kind of links nicely to the next couple of songs, which ratchet up the tempo again. So, yeah, a great tune.
And in terms of the, because the female sexual assault side of things, like, well, I guess I, because I was wondering, is it written from the female perspective? Or
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. That's my understanding.
Yeah, because that's what I thought of it. And, yeah, I tried to read through the lyrics and try and figure out, but, yeah, it seems like that. But
well, on the lyrics, there's another kind of like lyrics.com, whatever those websites are called. I'm sure they've got this wrong. So the first lyric is like, while our folks would drink, and I think the website casks. Say, and curse the sand. And I'm like, it's not curse the sand. Isn't it casks of Perth Lausanne or something? Is there some kind of, do you know what kind of cask wine was around back in the 70s or 80s?
No, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good point. I thought it was drink casks and curse the sand. I don't know, maybe because the sand was hot on the beach.
Right, okay, maybe I'm wrong. Yeah, right. Yeah. I thought, are they cursing the sand? Like, I thought it was casks of something, but anyway. maybe
fun
it's
and
one
games
between websites and John O'Duncan. So I'm happy to sort of take a draw after our
I smell official youandmylyrics.com coming up as a
by John O'Duncan.
Yeah, as a money earner. but yeah, this song is cool, how it's got the crescendo. And so in terms of keeping your secrets safe, is that like an insidious thing? Is that kind of like the perpetrator of the crime being like, I'll keep your secret safe? Or is it more a case of like finding a confidence, someone you actually trust to keep your secrets are safe with me?
Yeah, or that I can't find it in me to sort of tell anyone about it, and I haven't got to the point where I can, you know, tell someone or find help. So in a kind of weird way, your secrets are safe with me because you've kind of imposed this trauma on me, and I'm in a straitjacket, basically. That's where that's how I've kind of got it in my mind. So inadvertently, your secrets are safe with me because you've basically backed me in a corner. I can't do anything about it.
Well, that's heavy as fuck. I'd never really thought about that, but well, adds a new meaning to it. This is why we do the podcast.
Yeah, that's
folks.
How I've taken it. Yeah, I don't know that.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, track six, Thuggery. This is a rip snorter.
Sure is.
So what do you think?
I have a great memory of this tune. Opening their gig at the Enmore during that Convicts tour, Tim rocking a leather jacket. The sound was on point that night. Like, absolutely nailed the harmony near the end. It was just a brilliant way to start the gig, you know, similar to what you're saying with the road performance, a really authoritative way to start a gig. And I think the ending of this song is up there with my favorite all-time You Are My song endings. You know, How Much Is Enough comes to mind too. Actually, another song on this record, Constance George, is another. This song, when Tim like half whispers, come on little man up there, what don't you get, da-na-na, it's just like so cool and a bit ominous. It's just immense. It's a brilliant song.
Yeah. Snap on the live experience. on the Convicts tour, they played Metro's Frio, and they began the gig, would have been the same tour. And yeah, I remember the same thing with just Tim and his electric guitar. And, you know, when singers do that, they'll sometimes come out with the acoustic guitar, or it's like they'll have an electric, but the voice will be so much louder. But I remember just his electric guitar and his voice was kind of like the guitar was loud and it was kind of crackling, and you could feel like it was on the verge of breaking. And so then when it did, it was fucking great. And the kind of just the energy of the tune, as in terms of lyrically, it just seems kind of like almost like a theatrical, it's like a fight on the mine site or something. I'm like a Kalgoorlie, do you kind of know what's going on in terms of, it just seems like,
not really,
it seems like, so he's like got his own, if Guy Ritchie made a film set on a Kalgoorlie mine site, and Tim has a soundtrack like a fight scene. That's what I'd imagine, where the the Night Watchman or something is just, you know, when in the opening bit, and then it just cracks open when the band comes in and chaos ensues. But yeah, also I swear, this era of the band and just kind of the energy of it. It was a while ago on YouTube. They were playing a gig for this tour. And in the it was for like Coke was doing this series back in the day, Live and Local or something, where it was like gigs targeted at like uni kids or something. And I remember they were actually playing, you referenced the leather jacket, but they're all kind of like in leather jackets looking cool, like a like Greasers type of vibe. And they were playing Friends Like You in the clip, but at the beginning, the front row, there were kind of like all these like 18-year-old uni student girls who were probably listening to the presets or Van Shee or something like that. And there's just this one great, well, like, you know, they got the cameras on the band that launch into with Friends Like You, and then it cuts to the front row, and there's just like this uni student. She looks like a first year Bachelor of Science student. She's kind of like pulling away, kind of like in fear. Not in disgust, or just kind of like the energy, the rock and roll, was too much to behold. And I think that, the end of this song in particular, I've been listening to, I saw that Tim recently with the Hard-Ons played a tribute to the guy from The Saints who died. They did that cover of Know Your Product at the Arias. And I know you and I have covered that song as well, but just like with the, in that particular song, it's kind of like punk, but they've got the horns and the kind of bombastic nature as well. And I think that there's kind of like a similarity there with the way that the horns really add something to the kind of theatrical bombast of the end of this song as well, where if it was just kind of like the band, it would, wouldn't kind of get to that, it wouldn't stretch to the stratosphere, which I feel like it does. So big fan of the
slight side note on this, Tom, from the This Is All About Me files, I guess, but at this time in my life, I was still trying to get friends into UMI. I mean, they'd come along to gigs with me and enjoy the show, but I wanted them to love them like I loved them. And so I remember being really annoyed at this gig that I mentioned at the Enmore at my friends that night when they went to get beers just before UMI came out, and they missed Thuggery, which I just thought was such a good rendition and a perfect and essential, you know, way to start that gig. And I remember walking out with them after the show and, you know, I said, what did you think? And they were like, yeah, it was good. And I'm in my mind, I'm bitterly thinking, good. You missed the ultimate start to the gig. Of course, you only said good. But I started to realize at that moment that was never really going to work out. You can't force things on people. So anyway.
Track 7, By My Own Hand.
Yes. Another one that's thematically heavy, essentially talking about suicide, I guess. And it is confronting to hear it referenced so directly. But yeah, another immense track. Davey's brilliant here, probably one of his best solos, and his backing vocals are a big reason why this song works as well as it does. the line, I'm one bad gig out of a Jason recliner, one bad song, and I'm back at the diner, yeah, eating your scraps, cleaning your crap, but you just don't get it. That line kind of gives you the sense of some of the pressure Tim's either felt or put on himself over the years. And I guess that's the flip side of being lauded, that feeling of not wanting to compromise on the levels that you've set for yourself, I guess. But and then an accumulation of, you know, life's pressures and things like that. So it is a pretty heavy song, but in a similar vein to Secrets, in that's thematically heavy, but a different subject matter, but just as heavy.
Yeah, I would say, you know, for me, this is like the epitome of an album track. And I feel like sometimes when you say album track, that is code for like the weakest song on the, or maybe the second weakest song on the album. But in this instance, I think by my own hand, if an AI technology got all the other songs on this record and like smushed them together, themes and guitar sound and I guess tempo and all that, it would be this. And so I feel like it's kind of it's great because I feel like it's a continuation. It, like I said before, in terms of the fact that track four is Nervous Kid and you still got that energy pushing it through, I like the fact that you've, for me, I find like Nervous Kid and By My Own Hand are kind of like similar tunes in a sense in terms of the way they sound. So I love that the energy continues. I love the lyric, you're trying to fix a shark wound with a cotton ball. So that's and it's weird how, because I've read Tim's book and kind of know a bit of the story from what he's told, and I guess reading stuff, listening to interviews, you kind of know what was going on. But at the time, I had no idea that this, you know, it was as dire as he was kind of, you know, he was very direct and honest about all the shit he was going through. And so I'm trying to think, like, what was the appeal to me when I was like 19 years old? Like, what? And I think that it's probably like a sense of desperation in that he was probably like in his, I'm guessing, mid-30s at the time or something, and like feeling like a sense of desperation, like, oh, fuck, you know, my marriage is done. I've got to make a go of this musician career again. I'm starting again. And that sense of desperation, I think when you're a young man or a young woman, you've got your whole life ahead of you. You've still got time, but there's still a sense of desperation to be like, fuck, I've got this new adult body and I'm having adult relationships and doing adult things, but I still don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And a sense of imposter syndrome. And I feel like that was probably what pulled me into this, because it's fun and it's kind of the energy, it's high energy and it's rocking, but there's also kind of like an underlying sense of feeling kind of a bit lost and unsure of yourself, which I think resonated with me at the time subconsciously. I don't think I was aware of that's why I was enjoying these kind of songs at the time.
It's funny, like when you're in your 30s, I guess, and you feel like you should have your shit together, but and you think you're running out of time, you can't quite grasp, even though you know mathematically that you should have much more time in the future than you've experienced in your whole life to get things sorted. And there's plenty of time, you know, you might be 32, but you've probably still got 50 odd years to go. So don't stress too much. But when you're in the midst of it, you're like, oh, you're looking around going, they've got it sorted.
Yeah.
I feel like, What am I missing? So, yeah, it can feel a bit claustrophobic. So that's kind of how I relate to that particular tune.
All right, track eight, The Sweet Life. Yeah. Johnny Dunks, tell me your thoughts.
Look, Tom, you're beautiful, but you're fucked.
Thanks. I've been waiting for you to tell me that.
I love that's a great starting line. I love how this song brings some roll into what hitherto has mostly been rock and precedence. My experience with this song also taught me a salutary lesson in how other opinions can inadvertently affect their own. So I remember listening to this album the first few times and absolutely loving this track and rating it amongst my favourites. And then a few weeks later, I found a review saying, yeah, good album, but loses some momentum at this track. And I remember thinking, that's weird. And then I think subconsciously I took that on board and started rating it less highly in my mind and even started skipping it. But I'm glad I caught myself. I did catch myself soon enough and realize what was happening in my mind and what was going on. So because I love this song and I particularly love how Tim delivers the vocal throughout the song. So great tune. Great tune.
Yeah, for me, I think the lyric that unlocks the whole song is, if you say you love someone insane, why would you want them to change? That is the crux of many relationship issues down the years, I think. I've always been a crazy guy. Well, I thought that's what you signed up for. And then that changes. And I think that this kind of gets into a new territory musically with the other compared to the earlier tracks on the album. But I think it's really, this album is great because it's the same message over and over again. Perhaps some brief forays into the kind of the storytelling of secrets and childhood memories of Nervous Kid. But it's just the heartbreak is real. And you can feel it on a song like this. And I believe on the last episode, I clumsily talked about how, I guess I was pondering, we've grown up with you and I, we've always seen them very much in the vein of the rock and roll tradition. How would someone from another culture interpret them taking, you know, blues and roots sounds and, you know, making it their own? Would they see it as authentic, or would they see it as some kind of weird Australian knockoff of the real thing? And, you know, even just kind of posing that, you sound kind of like, I guess I want to be clear, like, for example, on this song, I think it's got this kind of like really sweet bluesy lead lick that Davey does at the end. Yeah. And yet, you know, it's this kind of like extremely personal story. And, you know, I've essentially, to be, set the record absolutely clear, that you're not thinking that I'm someone who cares about appropriation or whatsoever, is sure, a track like this, it means fuck all whether you're Australian or Belgian or from Papua New Guinea. If you can find the tools and the fucking right sounds to convey the emotion, then who gives a shit about all that stuff? So you mentioned walking around kicking yourself and being like, why did I pick that for the bronze song? I hadn't listened back to it, but I was thinking, like, did I express myself clearly to state that I was purely just thinking out loud, wondering if other people had judged Australian artists like I had judged artists from other cultures who weren't from the antebellum South singing blues songs in the past. So anyway,
no, it's all good. It's one of the, this podcast, where it brings up certain questions and we talk it through. So no, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, mate. All right. Track 9, Gunslingers.
What a tune, Tommy. The opening riff makes this an instant live classic. It's one of those riffs that looks really cool too, if you know what I mean. You know, when you widen your stride and you just let that guitar chime.
And
Rusty's beat here is perfect for the song. He doesn't overplay things, just knocks out a solid thumping, thudding beat, which lets the guitars do their things. And yeah, I only noticed this last night when I was listening to it washing the dishes, but Davey's lead on it throughout the song is really, really clever and important, and I hadn't really noticed it until last night after hearing the song hundreds of times. But he's just playing like this kind of subtle, nerdly lead over the top of throughout the whole song, and yeah, it kind of gave me a new appreciation of the lead guitarist. It's not just someone who plays the solos and looks cool, also does a lot of legwork in the background.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, it kind of little chiming lead that kind of adds to the, because I guess the rest of the stuff is relatively, you know, straightforward, the other instrumentation. So he kind of fills in the gaps really nicely with his little chiming lead and then the ripping solo. Yeah, I mentioned this on one of the prior episodes where I was at Southbound Festival in Busselton. I was asleep before the main acts. My drug dealer put some drugs in my face and woke me up in my tent, and I stumbled towards Wolf Mother and had the time of my life. The last chords of Joker. Yeah, Joker and the Thief saw us out, and then I stumbled over to UMI. And I believe this was the song I like as I kind of went from one stage to the other. And Tim was kind of in a bit of a state that night. I remember he saying, "No one fucking likes us anymore." He was, and he had, I remember he was swigging from directly from a long bottle of wine, which just looked extra long in my impaired state. And shirtless, you know, balmy night. And yeah, this song sounded insanely good live. And I just remember, and go, and he just like, yeah, leapt into the air. So tons of rock and roll tomfoolery. As I mentioned before, early Kings of Leon would have paid good money to have had an opportunity to make this song theirs back in the day, because I feel like even the songs I really like on their first two albums don't really compete with this tune. It's amazing. And yeah, I guess I was kind of wondering, we talked about that article from The Age last week, which I think came out a couple years before Convicts came out, and I think that was titled something along the lines of like Tim Rogers, the last gunslinger in town or something. So I guess, do you feel like, I guess thinking about the kind of concept of being a convict and being you know, this is your lot in life, you've been sentenced to kind of, well, you've been sentenced to live out your sentence, do you feel like this is him kind of embracing that identity that was put on him as the kind of outsider cult hero Tim Rogers by the Australian media?
Yeah, look, that was my kind of impression of the song when I first heard it, like the last gunslinger in town. Like he's kind of the last, I don't know, to want of a better word, authentic kind of character in music. But I think Tim cleared that up in one of the interviews around this time. I think he was talking to Carolyn Tran from Triple J. They did like an hour-long show, Tim and Davey, and they went through track by track explaining each of the songs. And I think maybe Carolyn asked, "Is this kind of about you?" And he goes, "No, no, no, it's not about me. It's about another character that he knows of, and kind of, it's a story about him, how he's like he's just lived his life as a gun for hire, you know, on the tools with the guitars." So, but it seems there must be some kind of self-reference throughout, though, in terms of like, I don't know, recording in LA and all that sort of stuff. It feels familiar, but apparently it's not about him specifically, but there's probably some personal moments in there, I would imagine.
Yeah, that it is the most boring question in the world in terms of like, is this about you? But I just thought it was interesting because he seems like, he would be the last person to, he seems like he defines his own character within music and outside of music. So I kind of struggled to find any other, at least kind of very obvious kind of parallels where it's like, oh, he seems to be directly talking about this in his song. But yeah, I guess ultimately there are quite a lot of people like Tim Rogers and quite a lot of people he probably bumped into within the music industry, kind of like live life on their own terms and then
that we have no idea about.
Who are approaching middle age and then like maybe he looked up to as a hero or something. It was like, yeah, he deserves a song and I'm gonna be a bit like him. So track 10, Constance George. What are your thoughts?
This is a great part of the album. Tracks 10 and 11, things get a bit weird musically, I reckon, for a couple of tracks. And it's like a gem-filled hidden corner of the album. This particular tune packs so much into 90 seconds. A story about an older woman living it up after escaping the straitjacket of nuclear family life, I reckon. And, you know, then there's some cool horns and yelps at the breakdown. And the delivery of the line, "She walks with the goose step and cooks like it's a can-can," is example number 700,000,097 of why Tim is a brilliant songwriter. It doesn't just have to be writing exquisitry that just looks good on a page, though we can do that. It can just be a line that ideally fits the song and is delivered perfectly. And like I said earlier, a fantastic ending to this tune, you know, Rusty. Yes, it's just a great song. So much packed into 90-odd seconds.
Yeah, I've got a confession to make. I think back in the day, I gave up on this album after Gunslingers. And when I say gave up, I would like, well, these are my favorite songs.
Yeah.
I'm just going to listen to something else because 10, 11, 12, not the way, you know. And I think it is because there is a consistency for the first 9 tracks. Mm. And then the last 3, it changes it up. And I recall with Constance George, it was actually an anecdote. It was at the Big Day Out again, and it might have been the Big Day Out where I saw Tim play solo with Tex, the TNT, at the very end of the night with their little acoustic performance. I believe he was playing with UMI at the same festival earlier in the day, which I missed. Right. I was elsewhere, but I remember my buddy went. And then he was saying how amazing the show was, and then he just kept saying, "She's got soul." Like, it might have been on the train back to Joondalup. He just kept repeating it. And just the, you know, when someone tells you a story and you're like,
"Yeah,
I wasn't there. I don't even really understand, but I'm laughing just as hard as you," or appreciating it. He conveyed how fun the show was. And ever since that moment, I got this song. I got, and I was like, oh yeah, this is the fun one on the album, and kind of like having fun in the studio. You can tell they're like fucking around and like, let's try something crazy, and it works. I feel like this is the second trashier hotel room track on the album. Like, you could almost imagine, but maybe Thank God I've Hit the Bottom instead of Trashier Hotel Room. It's John O'Duncan and his army of underage street teamers going out and trying to personally find members of Powderfinger and any corresponding fans they have in Australia and beating the fuck out of them with baseball bats. Whereas Constance George is perhaps the more apt Trashier Hotel Room. Not that anyone in UMI or affiliated to UMI condones that type of activity, but if you were going to for a feature film, for a stage play, for something, candles by candlelight in a what's it called, a divot thing where everyone sits, an amphitheater, for a divot thing, the man who calls himself a writer is saying he's calling amphitheaters divot things. Fucking hell. Yeah, no, this song is amazing, and it takes it to the next level.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it takes us nicely into the other gem of this corner of the album, Explain and Cricket. So
Yes.
My favorite. You want to?
No. I just got disrupted because someone entered my bedroom door, but there was the workers fixing the sink. Now I'm back on track. Sorry if I stepped on you.
All good.
Continue talking about.
Yeah, my favorite UMI t-shirt doesn't exist anymore, but it's the Explaining Cricket t-shirt where Libertà, the Roman goddess of liberty, instead of carrying a flame, holds aloft a cricket bat, and definitely proved to me that you can love something to death. I essentially killed this t-shirt. I wore it until there were holes in it. I kept wearing it until the holes became the main feature of the t-shirt. And then when the t-shirt ultimately became indistinguishable from the air that we breathe. But a great song, again, mining the limitless depths of childhood anecdote. There's a sweetness to the memories too. You know, I knew my zildjians from my paradiddle, plugged straight into the stereo and watched the damn thing blow. You know, I loved us because we never had a clue. And another brilliant solo from Mr. Lane. So, yeah, I really love this tune.
And just on a personal level, me and Jono, we had the, I guess it depends how you want to look at it, the displeasure of working in a pretty weird office, but the pleasure to be able to meet one another and make a lot of great memories. And I recall it's kind of like how this pod really began, is there was one casual Friday you wore a UMI shirt. And that's how I discovered that you were a UMI fan. Yeah, because I'd moved over from Perth like a year and a half before to finish uni, and then I'd started working in the office. It was my first, one of my first few casual Fridays. And then Johnny Dunks ran the UMI. I was like, you're my fan. And you're like, I am the UMI fan. You didn't go quite that far, but I was like, I realized I was in deep waters. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah,
in about 15 years, I'm going to be hosting a podcast with this guy. This is going to get serious.
Yeah, yeah. It's like when you wear a t-shirt like that and someone goes, oh, you're a UMI fan, you kind of have to kind of feel them out. Okay, how deep are we going to go here? Like, how serious are you? Like, because we can keep this at a high level. It's like, yeah, I'm a UMI fan, next subject, or we can go pretty deep for the next 3 or 4 hours. So I was kind of like, yeah, tell me more. What do you want to know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you were kind of, you had all the power. But yeah, hopefully proved myself that I was interested and eager to learn more. But explaining cricket, what a great sound. Yeah, I feel ashamed that I kind of was skipped this one. And you know, I'm going to say it's pretty much a former stoner. Every now and again, I will imbibe the old devil's lettuce just for a bit of a few giggles. But I feel like this is one of the few UMI songs. It sounds amazing when you're stoned. They're not a stoner band. They're not Caius. But their songs don't sound worse when you're stoned. But I feel like this one is like amazing, giggly, just fun, frolicking. Mm-hmm. It kind of obvious Ray Davies influence, the Kinks, We Are the Village Green, Preservation Society era Kinks. And I don't know, it's a funny, any Australian cricket fans can kind of attest the difficulty explaining cricket to Americans, even though it's essentially the same fucking thing. They can't seem to figure it out.
Yeah.
And I guess the lyric that jumps out at me, where did we all get the need for the daily medication? The kind of the bright-eyed youthfulness of being a young tacker, and then you eventually grow up and you're like, these are the things that I need to just get by. And all your big dreams seem to get put to the wayside. You just need your little fixes to help you sustain yourself from day to day, which is a little sad, but the reality.
Well, I have a slightly different take on that, Tommy, in that, you know, reading Detours, and he had that time in his late teens or early 20s when I think he had some problems, and they basically over medicated him, and it sort of really affected him. So I wonder if he's looking back going, we were such sweet kids and I had one problem, and you totally like fried my brain where do we get all the need for the daily medication? We were sort of, you know, having fun. We were plugging things into the stereo and watching it blow. We didn't have a clue. And then
that's a really good point.
Later. Yeah, yeah. So that's how I kind of took it. But yeah.
Yeah, great song. I think fits well, really well on this. All right. To close this out, track 12, I'm a Mess. Johnny Dunks, tell me your thoughts.
What a way to finish this album, and kind of unexpected when you first hear it. In many ways, it's a typical UMI like pop rocker. But it stands out as unique on Convicts after 11 tracks that are, you know, pressing and immediate. You get this absolute gem. It's almost like the band's coming out from behind the curtain and saying, hey, guys, don't worry. We're still here. We're still the guys you kind of always knew. We just need to get something off our chest. An ideal ending to the album yet again. And Davey's lick to take us home is really simple.
Oh,
but it's
absolutely
perfect. A brilliant way to bring home, you know, us stragglers after a big sort of consequential experience.
Yeah, I would agree. I would. I had my music journo hat on again, and to try and redeem myself after just calling an amphitheater a divot thing. I want to say that the outro with the ding ding ding. I think that you could call that, and with what hap you know, Rusty lets it fly on the drums and the I'd call the outro expansive. I think that we're pushing it out there, where you can kind of just imagine the, because yeah, as you said, it's got the standard kind of very much like a obvious pop rock intro, and then the kind of build. But then I think at the end we get elevated to somewhere else, and we're thinking about the future. And yeah, and I think just thematically, as I mentioned at the beginning, Thank God I've Hit the Bottom is kind of like someone thinking about the joy in actually finding their bottom and being like, well, that's great. Now I can go back. The only way is up. I'm a mess is the actual bottom. Like when you're wallowing in it a little bit and you're gonna just have to ride it out when you're down. So I think it's kind of like a beautiful way to end, because it's seemingly the it's what comes up must go down type of thing. And the fact that it closes it out, and then if you wanted to listen to it again, you can go up. So you couldn't maybe it would be a nice way to end if Thank God I've Hit the Bottom. And I know that they ended some shows with that, thank God, around this era. You couldn't really begin the album with this, but
No.
it's yeah. But I think the outro kind of gives it a nice kind of like expansive, optimistic outro to a pretty kind of like someone just dealing with their own shit and everything that's happened to them throughout the song.
Yeah, the outro makes me want to listen to the song again straight away. Like I'm a person, some people you hear where people listen to songs over and over again, the same song. I've never really been that person, but this outro kind of makes me want to just press it, skip back to start the song again, because it's just a real beauty. And I guess, yeah, you finish this album, and I've been trying to think about how to explain or describe this album. There's basically one word that keeps coming into my mind, and it's immense. I think that kind of says it all. But musically, I'm curious on your thoughts, because your musical knowledge is probably wider and broader. How would you describe it? Like, is it, I don't know, punkish? Is it garage rocky? Is it just hard rock? Is it, how would you describe the sound of it?
Yeah, I think it's garage rock, like that's, but there's something the way the guitars are recorded, there's more kind of like, I would say, sheen on them. There's still a lot of dirt and grit, but it's yeah, it's still very much kind of like in terms of the way the songs are constructed. So yeah, I would say just kind of like high energy garage rock would be kind of the way that I'd describe it. And yeah, there's a real consistency of energy throughout the whole album, really. There's some minor detours, but compared to the earlier Yo and My albums, I think there's far greater fluctuation in terms of the energy. I think this is just kind of like a constant ride, and it feels like the band and you know the vocal, they're being spat out in a good way. Yeah, so
And
that's how I'd answer that.
an important record, I guess, to remind some people, if they need a reminding, that You or My can climb through the gears if and when they want to, I guess. They started with Sound as Ever. There would have been a generation of people's like, oh, when are we gonna hear another, album that really rocks our socks off, kind of thing. And I guess, not that they were trying to do this, but this album would have played the role of just reminding those kind of people. It's like, well, you know what? We can still ratchet it up if and when we want, in the way that we want. And I think it would have made a lot of people go, oh yeah, geez, that's right. They can really rock hard. Sorry, I was trying to think of a better way to say that.
They sure can, mate. Before we get into the podium, do you feel like there's anything of note we should discuss in terms of, because I remember this was like, they were, yeah, this is kind of like in the thick of like the Jets resurgence and stuff like that. And I remember, yeah, Tim Rogers would come out and he did, I remember when I was a big Jet fan back in the day, Jet had this like Channel V, live at the Channel V studios in Sydney. And then Tim Rogers came out and did Get What You Need with Jet in that era. And it was funny because, yeah, and it was referenced on one of the Triple J docs where they were saying like, oh yeah, I'm considered kind of the weird older uncle of Jet and the Vines and stuff like that. And I guess it was kind of like, at least for me, it was, I get, and it, probably a lot of people of my generation, it really did open my eyes because I was the one who was getting marketed the Vines and Jet and then went through the back catalog. And then even though the guys in you and I were a little bit older, I was like, I'd put Convicts. It was in my heavy rotation with Get Born and Wolf Mother, whatever the other shit I was listening to at the time. It was right in there. So I'm guessing this album probably opened them up to a lot of younger fans like myself at the time.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like when I went to see Tim the other night, I took my girlfriend with me, and she, like 3 or 4 weeks previously, we'd seen Tex Perkins at the same venue down the road. And when we went up to, we walked up to Tim Rogers and the Twinset gig, and she was like, am I going to be the youngest person here again? And I'm like, well, I really didn't, notice, like, because I'm kind of used to those kind of shows and being kind of, I guess, younger than most of the audience. But we got to the Tim show and she's like, oh, wow, there's heaps of people that are younger than us. And I think, yeah, Tim and UMI have been able to renew their fan base to an extent, you know, low level, I guess, compared to really big bands. But there has been like a renewal of the fan base, and maybe this album played a part in that as well. So, yeah, just at that time, you're right. I do remember Jet and the Vines kind of taking the limelight, and Rock was back, and I guess Kings of Leon and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, UMI had kind of released Dress Me Slowly and Deliverance, and they didn't quite land. And then it's like, oh, Convicts. Yeah, yeah. It's really a way of going, this is how it's done, you know?
Yeah.
This is how it's done. So for me, it was like affirmation in a way. Like, yes, I love this band. Now I can show my friends. I mentioned my friends before, how I tried to get them into UMI in the preceding few years and never quite got there. But they, you know, they loved this album, for example. They went out and bought it. I remember just being shocked when a friend came to me and said, oh, I bought Convicts the other day. I love it. I haven't stopped playing it in my car. I'm like, what? This is amazing. Yeah. So, yeah, it was that kind of album. It's like, yeah, this is how it's done. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, just hearing you talk it through, you know, there's that expression, there's like the comedian's comedian, the one that there's the popular guys and then there's the guy over to the side, doesn't have the fan base, but all the top comics love him and I've learned everything from. And I feel like you and my kind of seem to occupy similar space around this era where there were all these huge bands, but there were all these popular bands who were touring internationally. They were like, oh yeah, when I was 14, I wanted to be Tim Rogers and now I get to share a stage with him. And so I think that goodwill, like I remember around this time, shortly after Convicts, my few buddies started moving over to Melbourne. They started meeting people and said that like, oh yeah, my friend's a barber and he cuts the guys from UMI's hair. And like, I was like, oh, that's so fucking cool. And like, and I was like, oh, that's, you know, there is the framing of like, we didn't become a big international act. We didn't tour America and find fans over there, enough fans over there and buy big houses in the Hollywood Hills. Is that, I guess you could consider that a failure. But then if you've got tons of people who love you and you live in a rock and roll city and you're a cult hero, that's still pretty fucking good as well. There were lots of guys and gals and bands in the 90s who don't get anywhere near to that. So I take this era, even though despite everything going on in Tim's personal life and rock was back, like it or not, at the time it was kind of popular again. And so I feel like this was kind of like a weird little victory lap they got to do and probably was validating to be like, yeah, we were a huge band and we've got these new kids who are inspired by us who are doing big things. That must feel good. If you can get over your kind of like jealousy or your kind of that should be me type of vibe.
Yeah.
It sounds, I don't know, maybe it's just because caught up in the energy of the record and the live shows, but it seemed like a fun, exciting time to be in UMI again.
Yeah, I agree. And it does make me think about the nature of fame and popularity. Like there's clearly a law of diminishing returns, right? So if I do a podcast and, you know, I might get five or six people say, you know, good show and stuff, and that makes me feel good. You know, I get the dopamine hit. And I guess I'd feel even better if, you know, 20 people said it or 100 people said it. But there'd be a moment or a threshold where it doesn't feel better anymore. Like it's like once you reach a million people or 1,000 or 200 sort of saying, great job, but you don't get any incremental hit from that. So it's like,
yeah, I've always wondered about that. And I think that the irony is that to actually sustain a living from art, you actually need a million strangers to like you and you not have the bandwidth to appreciate it. That's the only way that you could possibly like earn money and sustain yourself. So it's this weird thing where it's like, you've got to chase that, you know, Roger Waters called it the wall or whatever, because he spat on a fan. Apparently that's how the concept came about when he was playing a show, and he was disgusted with himself afterwards. And he realized that's because he put up a wall between himself and the audience as the band had got bigger. And I was but that is kind of a necessary evil if you want to become a big band. So if that doesn't work out and you don't become Pink Floyd, you get to be a cult hero and people to actually shake your hand or stand nervously next to you before you're about to play with the hard-ons.
I think that's kind of terrain that we can mine a bit more in future episodes, because it's something that I'm trying to work out in my head around UMI and how it's panned out for them and how it may well be ideal or all that sort of stuff around the nature of popularity and would more have been better, would less have been better, where have they landed? So, yeah, it's interesting terrain, I reckon.
Defos. All right, as we always do, medal ceremony. Jono, give us your bronze, silver and gold for Convicts. I'm interested in this one.
Yeah. As always, tricky one. I'm going to go bronze. I'm a mess. Yeah, I mean, the way this track finishes the album and that lick at the end just makes me want to repeat it. It's a rarity in my life that I repeat things straight after listening to them. So that's my bronze. Silver, Constance George. I'm constantly amazed at the end of the song that it only went for 90-odd seconds. So much is packed into it. And gold has to be Nervous Kid. That is a revelation to me. It's 2-minute therapy. I feel like someone understands me. Unlike my friends who didn't get it when I asked them, did they ever get nervous before school? No, this song gets it. So bronze, I'm a mess. Silver, Constant George. And gold, Nervous Kid. How about you?
That's a handsome podium you've got there. I reckon. So I'm gonna go. Oh, this is tough. All right. So I'm gonna go. Fuck. I'll say for bronze, thank God I've hit the bottom.
Yeah.
Actually, scratch that. Bronze, I'm gonna go Gunslingers.
Yeah.
Silver, thank God I've hit the bottom, and the gold will be Thuggery.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
this is a tough one, but, yeah, I feel like – thank God I've hit the bottom. I feel like even though it's, you know, pretty simplistic compared to the other songs, the statement aspect of it, I guess probably the more meta component to it – it's impacted my life in a big way, and it's kind of made me thinking about like, how do you start things, how do you purposefully alienate people with an intention in mind, and the other two are just kind of like amazing tunes. So that's
a beautiful podium.
Yeah.
I'm envious, but I'm happy with mine, but I'm envious. Whenever I hear your podiums, there's a bit of envy that comes across me. I'm like, it's a good podium.
Podium envy. It'll be the death of us all. All right. So that's convicts in the bag. Mm. We got dilettantes up next. And Jono, we forgot to talk about this before we started recording. Jono's done us a solid, and he started up a Twitter handle. Jono, why don't you tell the good folks about this?
Yeah, we just started a Twitter handle. So it's like, what is it called? It's called Jewels and Bullets, I think.
Not catchy. I'll tell you that. Yeah,
it's not catchy. No, there's not much left over now on Twitter. It's hard to find. I think it's like
underscore. I think there's an underscore in there.
I do an underscore.
Yeah, I'm on it now. So that's what I mean, not catchy. I'm not being a pedantic little bitch. It's at @YAE_JNBpotty. Either way, come on guys, you know how to click a link. It'll be in the episode link, and I'll go back and add it into all the links, and so you can Jono's man in the fort over on Twitter. I will I've got the emails. You can hit us up on jnbpotty@gmail.com, which isn't that much catchier, if I'm being truly honest.
I won't be asked to do like a guest lecture at like a business school about how to sort of generate marketing leads or something. You want something catchy. Underscores are not catchy.
Yeah, probably not. And look, touch and go for a while there with Twitter, as if like Jono had been like, you might have been the last Twitter account created before it all crumbled.
Yeah.
Elon and the 12 nerds left in SF to the keeping it afloat might have been like you might have made the Guinness World Book of Records. It's got a cool stat.
It was a weird time to start, yeah. But anyway. I thought to myself, don't underestimate the power of cult in human society. Like people love joining a cult, and he's got a hell of a personality cult, so I thought that'd be right.
Yeah, last week it was all over. This week they're doing fine again, so don't trust what you read on the internet, kids. Mm-hmm. Right, that's it. Stay tuned, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with dilettantes. Thanks, Johnny Dunks.
Thanks, mate. See ya.